Hello, and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Ki Titze. This week, Neiman Novetzky discusses Ki Titze. Neiman Novetzky is a faculty member at Pardes. Her focus is Tanakh. And now, Neiman Novetzky.
Thank you, Larry. This week, we read Parashat Ki Titze, the parsha which contains more mitzvot, more commandments, than any other parsha in the Torah. The commandments cover a wide range of topics, from hashavat aveda, returning a lost object, to laws dealing with war, to laws dealing with family life, and to business dealings. In this coming 20 minutes or so, we're going to discuss one of the laws that comes at the very beginning of the parsha, known as the laws of ben sorer umoreh, the law is dealing with a rebellious son. The law, in short, states that if you have a case in which a son acts disobediently to his parents, is rebellious, the parents have the right to take him to the elders and to have that son killed. The law takes place in about four verses, but raises many questions both on the textual and the ethical levels. Let's read the verses inside. Ki yel ish ben sorer umoreh, einenu shomea b'kol aviv u'b'kol imo, v'yisru oto v'lo yishma aleihem. If a man has a son who is rebellious, who does not listen to the voice of his father or to the voice of his mother, and they have rebuked him, but he does not listen to them, v'tafsu bo aviv v'imo v'otzi oto z'knei iro, the father and mother can take him to the elders of the city, v'amrul zikne ro, and tell the elders, b'neinu zeh sorer umoreh, this son of ours is rebellious, einenu shomea b'kolenu, he does not listen to our voice, zolel v'sovei, he eats and drinks gluttonously, urgamuhu kol anshei ro ba'avanim v'amit, and then the people of the city may stone him with rocks, and he shall die, ubi'arta harami b'kerbacha, and in this way you shall get rid of the evil from amongst you, v'chol Yisrael yishmu v'irau, and the rest of Israel shall hear and shall see. As I said, the psukim, the verses, raises many questions. First, we have a question of context. As I said before, Parashat Ki Titze contains a whole list of laws. What's the placing of our law? It comes right after two other laws that deal with relationship with a wife. The first one is what's called the captive wife. If one has gone to war and finds someone of the enemy whom they fall in love with, probably based on looks, what do you do? Are you allowed to take her as a wife or not? And the laws discuss all the different details as to what must be done before she's allowed to become your wife. Right after that is a law that details what happens when someone has two wives, one of which he loves and one of which he doesn't, and the one of which he does not like actually has the firstborn son. What rights do you have to either dismiss that son as a firstborn or not? The Torah says no, despite the fact that he's the son of the unloved wife, he still has the status of the firstborn. Then comes the verses that I read earlier. Is there any special meaning to this context? The fact that our laws about the rebellious son follow these two sets of laws about wives, is that telling for us? Does that help us understand our law any better? Second question is, what exactly does this child who we're bringing to be brought to death do wrong? We read two terms in the verses. The boy is called a sorer umoreh. What exactly does that mean? I translated it earlier as a rebellious son. But what exactly did the two terms themselves mean? Is there any other way of understanding this? Second, we saw that when the parents brought him to the elders, they referred to him as someone who was zolel v'sovei. Again, what do those two terms mean? And furthermore, what's the relationship between the two sets of terms, between sorer umoreh and zolel v'sovei? Third question, who is this child? From the verses, all we know is that he's a son. A disobedient son. Is there anything else that we know about him? Is there any other conditions that are set for one to bring him and label him a ben sorer umoreh? A follow-up question. What has to take place before the parents are allowed to bring him? It says in the verses that when the parents bring him beforehand, what had they done? V'yisruoto v'lo yishmalehem. That somehow they had rebuked him or they had punished him and he hadn't listened. What's included in that rebuke? How much rebuke has to precede them going to the elders, them actually punishing him with death? And finally, the biggest question of all. Why exactly does this son deserve death? What did he do that was so wrong? Because he's disobedient, you're going to go and kill him? A parent is going to want to bring their child? I mean, how bad could he have been? What exactly did he do? It doesn't say anything about him murdering. It doesn't say anything about him doing something so terrible. He was disobedient. All children are disobedient. Okay, maybe he drank, he ate too much. Is that a reason to kill him? And so this last question, this big ethical question, is of course one that has been dealt with by many over the years. So let's try to answer some of those questions. Let's start with the context. Chazal look at the context and they say, actually, yes, there's something that you can learn from the placement of these different psukim, of these different verses. There's a reason that the laws of the rebellious son follow the laws of what is known as Eshet Yifat Torah, the captive woman. What do Chazal say? They say, this is to teach you a lesson. One who marries an Eshet Yifat Torah, one who decides that after taking a woman in captivity and deciding that she's beautiful and therefore deciding that they want to marry her, if he actually marries her, what will be the result of such a union? They say, a ben sorer umore. One who has gone into that type of a marriage, they will have a rebellious son. Chazal then point to an example, and they suggest that David's son, King David's son Avshalom, was such an example. Even though it's not clear or explicit at all in the verses, they suggest that David had married an Eshet Yifat Torah. He had married someone who had been taken captive. Together they had the son Avshalom, and as we know from the stories in the book of Samuel, Avshalom rebels against his father, rebels not just in the teenager type of rebellion, but actually rebels against the kingship of his father, leading to an entire war. According to Chazal, the placement doesn't teach us so much about the Ben Sorer or Moreh, about our rebellious son, as much as it does about the evaluation of how one should read the permissibility of actually marrying a captive woman. Obviously, Chazal did not think that it was a very positive thing to do, even though one was allowed to do it. They viewed it as something that one should still not do because it was going to have negative effects. Dr. Dvorah Ushpizai, a psychologist, reasoned Chazal a slightly different way of looking at the connections. And she suggests that maybe the Torah is suggesting something really about the rebellious son, and that is, what leads someone to become a rebellious son? And she suggests that the placement is saying that sometimes the rebellious son is the product of a bad family dynamic. A family dynamic where the woman who had been married to the husband is not a marriage based on love, but perhaps on lust. Or if one has a family such that there's a loved wife and an unloved wife, that type of a family dynamic doesn't bode well for where the children are going to be and how they're going to grow up. And so she suggests that perhaps it's trying to give you the background as to, well, how could someone become such a rebellious son that your parents would actually want to bring him to be killed? And they place the, and she suggests that the blame is being placed here not just on the son, but on the family and the way they brought up that son and the type of relationships that had been going on in that family beforehand. Nonetheless, she does suggest or perhaps point out that that's not to say that the Torah is absolving the son of all blame, nor, on the other hand, saying that anyone of a broken family or a family in which the relationship between husband and wife is going to have a rebellious son. Just a suggestion of perhaps that's one of the factors that might lend itself to it. So let's move into our second question. This is a rebellious son. What in the world does that mean? What does the word sorer umoreh mean? What does the word zolel v'soveh mean? Almost all of the commentaries agree that the word sorer is related to the word lasur, to stray. And that in some ways what we're saying is that the son is straying from the path. The word moreh might be related to the word Meri, which means rebellion. That somehow this son is stubborn, rebellious, against man, perhaps against parent, God, the Torah, we're not sure. So most of them take it in this general type of meaning. What about Zulel the Soveh? So earlier I translated that as being eating and drinking gluttonously, which is how almost everybody translates it. Ibn Ezra points out that this perhaps doesn't necessarily mean eating and drinking literally, but a life that is one of eating and drinking, meaning a life in which one is interested only in the body and fulfilling the pleasures of the immediate now rather than chayolam haba, rather than thinking about the future world, the world to come, the spiritual side of life. So what's the relationship between the two terms? When we say that somebody is a ben sorero moreh, he's rebellious, what's the relationship between that and the fact that he eats and drinks more than he's supposed to? Is the first term, sorero moreh, the main term, that what we really are punishing about is being rebellious, and then so and zolel v'soveh, the gluttony aspect, is just one example of how that person is being rebellious? Or do we say that the second term defines the first? Meaning, when we say that he's being rebellious, it's not all rebellions that he's getting punished for, but this one specifically, that because he is gluttonous, that type of rebellion is what is being punished. So commentators differ as to how to answer this question. We'll start quite early on with Josephus, the historian from the time of the Second Temple period. Josephus emphasizes the aspect of a lack of kibud horim, the lack of honoring your parents, the rebellion aspect. I'll read to you a little bit of what he says. As to those young men that despise their parents and do not pay them honor, but offer them affronts, either because they are ashamed of them or they think themselves wiser than they, in the first place, let their parents admonish them in words. And he continues on giving examples of how the parents might admonish them. Then he points out that if it works, if the insolence of these young men be thus cured, let them escape the reproach which their former errors deserved. For by this means the lawgiver will appear to be good. But if it happens that these words and instructions conveyed by them in order to reclaim the man appear to be useless, then the offender renders the law's implacable enemies to the insolence he has offered his parents. And thus let him therefore be brought forth. For Josephus, the verse's emphasis is on the disrespect to parents, on the insolence of the young men, on the people who think that they are smarter than their parents, the people who will not pay their parents honor, but rather despise them. Philo reads the verses similarly, though he adds in another aspect, which explains part of what's so horrible about what this boy did. And that is the lack of hakarat hatov, the lack of gratitude, of recognition of all that your parents have given you. And so he starts by saying, this is in Philo's On Special Laws, for who can be more completely the benefactors of their children than parents, who have not only caused them to exist, but have afterwards thought them worthy of food, and after that again of education, both in body and soul, and have enabled them not only to live, but also to live well, training their body, and educating their soul by letters and numbers and geometry and music and every kind of philosophy. And so he lists all of the things that a parent normally does for their child. And he points out that it's for this reason that if the child then no longer obeys his parent, that it's all the more terrible. The question, of course, for Philo and Josephus then is, well, then what's the zolel v'soveh aspect? What's the aspect of the gluttony? So even though Josephus doesn't say it explicitly, one might suggest that for him, that was just one example, one way of the child being disobedient. Philo seems to go in a different direction. In his discussion on drunkenness, he makes mention of the rebellious son. And he says, the sacred law commands the disobedient and contentious man who brings contributions of evil, that is to say, who joins together and heaps up sin upon sin, great crimes on little ones, fresh guilt upon ancient, intentional upon involuntary misdeeds, and who, and this is the part that's important, like a person inflamed by wine, is always intoxicated and drunk, and raging with ceaseless and unrestrained drunkenness during the whole of his life, to be stoned. because he has drunk of the unmixed and abundant cup of folly, and because he has destroyed the injunctions of right reason, his father. Though there might be more than one way of reading Philo here, the way I had read it was that for him, the section about drunkenness is to be read as a metaphor, that one who doesn't listen to his parent is as if he is one who is drunk. Because what does it mean to not listen to your parents? What does it mean to be drunk? Drinking leads you to a lack of right reason. And that's exactly what your parents are supposed to be instilling in you. So if you leave your parent, you're leaving reason, thus you are drunk. And so Zolel the Soveid becomes a metaphor for the disobedience or for the effects of not listening to your parents, who are supposed to be the ones who tell you what's right from wrong, something that you can't do when you're drunk. Others read the relationship between the two terms in a slightly different manner. The Ramban suggests that here we have just two separate criterion, meaning you need to have two things that are going simultaneously wrong in your son. One is that lack of respect of your parents, that disobedience. And the other is a lack of what he calls the observance of the Pasuk Kidoshim to you. There's an injunction in Sefer Vayikra, in the book of Vayikra, that we have to be holy. And Ramban there explains that this is one of those general types of commandments that includes general, correct, proper behaviors. Since the Torah can't possibly include every single way of behaving, every circumstance that can come up, in this catch-all phrase of Kiddushim to you are included lots of little things of what's the proper way of leading a holy life. And one of those things is proper eating and drinking. And so he says that there's two separate conditions here. One is that the boy is disobedient. Secondly, that the boy is gluttonous, that he's not being or leading a holy life. A third approach is that found in the Midrash Halacha, the Sifrei on Devarim. The Sifrei reads, Enenu shomea b'kol aviv v'imau. Quoting the verse, he does not listen to the voice of his mother or father. They ask, Yachol afilo amrulo aviv imo lahadlika taner velo hidlik. Does this include a case where the mother or father told him to light a candle and he didn't light it? Would that alone be enough to be able to bring him to be stoned to death? Talmud lomar enenu shomea l'gzeira shava. Ma enenu shomea hamor lahalan zolel v'sovei. Af enenu shomea hamor kan zolel v'sovei. Using a certain type of Talmudic methodology called the Gzeira Shava, not so important for us right now, they come to the conclusion, no. When it says he doesn't listen, it's not all types of not listening. It's not even if I told him to please go and light the candle and he didn't light the candle. But what type of not listening? The type of not listening of Zolel v'sovei. In other words, the term, the word Zolel v'sovei explain the term sorer u'moreh. What kind of disobedience? A disobedience that involves gluttony. In the Mishnah, they go even further to define what constitutes this type of zolel v'sovei, this type of eating that's considered gluttonous behavior. You know, how much is considered gluttony? And so they give specific amounts of meat and drink that the son has to eat or drink in order to be considered a ben sorer u'moreh. And they add on to that certain conditions in which the eating and drinking had to take place. First of which is that in order to get the food, the son had to steal it, the money, from his father. Two, he has to eat it outside of the house. Three, he has to eat it not part of a mitzvah meal, meaning it can't be food that he ate like in partaking of the tithe or in partaking of some type of a celebration for chag or moed. In addition, they say, how does it have to be cooked? They said, if it's raw, that's not considered zolel v'sovei. And on the other hand, if it's fully cooked, it's not considered zolel v'sovei. Only if it's someplace in between. Some even say that when we say that they have to eat this amount of food, it has to be all in one bite, all at one time. So we see the Mishnah is adding many different criteria as to explain, well, what exactly are we referring to as gluttonous behavior, as zolel v'sovei? Many things which, of course, are not so clear from the verses themselves. We'll get back to trying to understand where Chazal is coming from in adding those extra conditions and what those mean in a couple of minutes. Our next question was, who is this boy? Here too, from the verses we don't know anything, except that he's a ben sover omore. Chazal add a few more details. One, they specify boy, not girl. Secondly, they add the age of this boy. They point out that this boy obviously cannot be what we call a katan, a young boy, because a katan is not punishable. He's not held accountable for his actions. So this boy has to be at least 13 years old in one day. At the same time, he's still called a ben. He's still called a son. And thus, he can't be considered what we would normally refer to as an adult. He's still somehow underneath the responsibility of his father. And so they suggest that what age range can this ben sover omore fall into? They say he has to have be from the time that he's 13 in one day, when he grows two hairs, until his beard starts. Which Chazal basically say is a period of altogether no more than 3 months. Finally, to our second to last question, we ask when the parents have to come to the elders. Beforehand, it says that they had to rebuke him. What does that rebuking consist of? Again, from the verses, it's not clear. Did they have to try 100 times? Did they have to beat him? What did they have to do? Once again, Chazal fills in some of the details, suggesting that they have to rebuke him orally, suggesting that they have to come a few times to a beating before they could possibly bring him to death. Meaning, first they come to a beating of just 3 people, they tell him what the son did, and they punish him with beatings and lashings, etc. Then they take him to a larger beating if nothing has happened in between, etc. In other words, it's a long process. We can't just wake up one morning and say, oh, my son is disobedient. You have to rebuke him. You have to rebuke him in front of witnesses. You have to go and bring him to the different levels of courts until you can finally get to the drastic measure of killing. In addition, Chazal put other limitations on the parents for bringing them to the elders and to that final process. Some of those seem arbitrary. Some of those are more clearly stemming from the text. The first thing they say is that this has to be a decision that is agreed upon by both man and wife. If just the father wants to bring the son or just the mother wants to bring the son, they can't bring him. They have to both agree. In other words, the son has to have done something so horrible that both mother and father have no mercy. Both of them think that he deserves this. The Mishnah then goes into a few more specifics. They say that the parents that bring him can't have any missing limbs. They can't be mute. They can't be blind. And they can't be deaf. And for each one, they go and find a verse to go and hook this condition onto. So, for example, they say the verse says, v'tafsubo, that the parent has to take him, has to catch him. Thus, they learn, the parent must have an arm. They say, the verse says, v'hotziu oto. They walk with him, they take him out, the parent must have a leg. V'amru, since the parent has to speak, then the parent can't be mute. They say to the elders, b'neinu zeh, this son, pointing at him. Thus, they say, they have to be able to identify him, they have to be able to see. They tell the elders, enenu shomea bekoleinu, he doesn't listen to us. Thus, Chazal learned, the parents have to be hearing. All these obviously seem to be somewhat stretches and reading out from the text, something that wouldn't have been simply there. And I think that if we start to add up and look at all the different things that we've seen in Chazal, the way they read the verses, we see a dual tendency. On one hand, we see a tendency to make the son out to be worse than a simple reading of the verses would have held. From the verses, we know that he's disobedient. Here we know in what ways he's disobedient. He's stealing from his parents. He's totally gluttonous, eating a large amount of meat at one time, eating it not in any way connected to any positive form, but in a total negative form. We see that both parents have to find him horrible enough to be bringing him, etc. On the other hand, we also see that Chazal have a tendency to try to add more and more conditions to make it harder and harder to actually ever bring a son to be stoned to death, because we have all these extra conditions that would have automatically exempted a parent from bringing him, having nothing to do with the son, right? Whether or not the father or mother is blind or deaf has nothing to do with how their son is acting, but they're already exempted from bringing their son. The boy can only be 13 in one day, and it only lasts for a period of 3 months, obviously exempting a whole slew of other factors and possibilities. And I think this dual tendency has something to do with our big question. We had asked beforehand, the big ethical question that comes out of these verses is, but why does the boy deserve death? What did he do that was so, so terrible that he deserved death? He didn't kill anybody. So what is it that he did that was so terrible? So we're going to look at two approaches and see how what we've been looking at in Chazal plays into them. The first one is from the Gemara, where they ask our question, Tanya Rabbi Yossi Haglili, Omer, Rabbi Yossi asks, V'chimim neisha achal zel tartema basar v'shata chatzi lud yayin haitaki amar tara yitzei levitin lizakel. Rabbi Yossi asks our question, because this boy ate too much meat and drank too much wine, we're going to go and tell him that he needs to be stoned? He answers, Ella higia Torah l'sof dato shal ben sorer mora. No. The Torah reached what is going to happen, what's at the end of the path for this ben sorer mora, which is what? Shesof migamer nechse aviv umivakesh limudo v'eino motze v'yotze l'parashat drachim umelastem et habriyot. He says, because what's going to happen? In the end, he's going to use up all the money of his father, meaning he's going to keep on stealing from his father to go and support his bad habits, until at one point, there's not going to be anything left to steal from his father. And so what's he going to do? He's going to go rob all the people around. Amra Torah, Yamut Zakai, Va'a Yamut Chayav. So the Torah says, better that he should die innocent than that he should die non-innocent. Because the death of evil people is a benefit for both them and for the world. This Gemara raises an interesting possibility, that what was the point of punishing the boy? Not because of what he's done already, but because of what he's going to do. He's nidon al shem sofo. He's judged for his end. Chazal say, because we know that this boy is going down a path that's going to end in horrible things, that's why we're punishing him now. And they give two different explanations as to why to punish him now. One, for his own good. Yamud zakai va'ayamud chayav. Let him die while he's still innocent. We don't want him to become an evil person. Let him die when he hasn't yet become an evil person. Second, they say, mitat risha'im hana'al olam. The death of evil people is a benefit for the world. We're killing him now not just for his own good, but for the benefit of the rest of the world. To protect everybody from what he's potentially going to become. Professor Habetel suggests that some of the things that we've seen in Chazal, the tendency to try to make the boy out to be worse than he is, fits along this general idea. Meaning, Nidon al Shem Sofo, he's going to be judged for his end. Once Chazal have made him into a much worse person than the verses seem to have presented, there's much more reason to think that he's going to go in that terrible route that Chazal suggests we're punishing him for. That said, this line of reasoning, this suggestion, or this explanation, I think, to some extent, causes more problems than it solves. If it's an ethical question as to what he did so bad that deserves stoning, it's just as much of an ethical question as to, can you punish someone for something they haven't yet done? In Torah, we don't believe in punishing someone unless there's evidence upon evidence upon evidence that they did something wrong. Right? You can't just kill someone who's supposedly a murderer. You have to bring witnesses. This person hasn't even done it yet. What do you mean bring witnesses? And so that approach, I think, we must leave with an open question mark. There's another approach that Chazal bring, and that is the idea that this is a case lo haya velo nihya, that this case of a ben sorer mora never was and never will be. Meaning what? There's never going to be a case when someone's able to bring their son as a ben sorer mora. And that's perhaps the tendency that we saw in Chazal, to limit the case so much that it's almost impossible to ever find a case where you're going to be able to bring your son in to be stoned. There's not going to be a mother and a father who both agree within that 3 month period to find their son having fulfilled all the conditions that need to be fulfilled, etc. If so, then what's in the Torah for? If it was never meant to be and never will be, then why do we have all these mitzvot? So the Gemara says, drosh v'kabel sachar. That the point here is that you should learn it, and from the learning you should gain a reward. What does that mean? Perhaps the idea is that there's still messages to be learned. We should be thinking about how our children are being raised, about the level of wrong there is in disobedience, and what we have to do in order to fix that. We're going to end with one last possible approach, and that's in the Tosefta in Sanhedrin. Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar says, Gzeirat Melechi. It's a decree of the king. In other words, sometimes the answers to our questions are simply, we don't know. And with that, I hope I've given you enough food to think about, and everyone have a Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Nima. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated, so please send an email to podcasts@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.